Coming up next, it's hour number two of the Dr. Future Show. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. And this hour, we bring you Dr. Bruce Damer, who we haven't heard from for at least 6 months now. Bruce is a Canadian-American multidisciplinary scientist. He works in the evolutionary biology world, looking at the question of the origin of life. And on the space world, he's been working on a Project Shepard, which is a concept spacecraft for encapsulating and handling icy planetesimals, I guess like asteroids, for science and resource utilization. Welcome back to the show, Bruce.
Thank you, Dr. Future and Mrs. Future.
Yes, you've been on quite an adventure for the last 6 months since our audience heard from you. The last time we spoke, it was about the Project Shepard. You were going to become a TED person. You were going to actually speak in Santa Cruz on TED, and that actually happened, right?
It happened.
All right. And,
you guys were there.
Yes, we were. We had some great videos of that. Those were some really great talks. Dr. Bruce opened the TEDx Santa Cruz and closed the TEDx Santa Cruz. It was so fun. Origin of life and future rocket asteroid projects. It was a really nice bookcasing there.
So let's start with Project Shepard initially, Bruce. Can you give us an update on that? Maybe describe to the audience a little bit about what's entailed with that project.
Yeah, it's really trying to create a breakthrough invention in space that will allow us to go and sustainably live in space. Mm. Because right now we have to lift all that fuel and water and hamburgers and supplies up from the surface of the Earth, and it's just expensive. Mm-hmm. So a group of us got together over the last few years and came up with this way of mining asteroids for all kinds of things in a safe way.
So this would be the beginning of what might be considered a solar system economy.
Yeah, in fact, as we were thinking this through, we realized that the Shepard spacecraft are kind of like they're miners. They're resource extractors. Mm. And in order for this to work, there will be grizzled figures like Han Solo of the 21st century going out and prospecting and finding rich targets and getting a mining claim on them. And then selling their claim or getting their claim jumped and things like that. But then the Shepard has to go out and encapsulate those asteroids and start to pull the resources out of them.
Do you think this could be a future scenario akin to the Wild American West?
I think it could be. I'm not predicting when it will happen, but in a sense, we've come up with what we believe to be like the fundamental invention, kind of like the steam engine was. You know, because in the American West, there were mountain men going across the landscape, living close to natives and the land, but it wasn't until steam engines and trains actually drove through the landscape that you got the real Wild West. And Shepard, I think, is kind of like a steam engine of the Wild West of space.
Hmm. Because it would provide the fuel for spacecraft to actually navigate without having to pay exorbitant amounts of resource to get them from Earth.
Yeah, I mean, you take your empty spacecraft on the way to Mars back up to a Shepard miner or a Shepard resource extractor, it would pop off its full tanks, and then you would swap out your empties, kind of like you do when you buy a carbon dioxide cylinder at the hardware store, you know, for your sodas. Huh. And off you go, and you probably have some lease agreement on that, like you do with your propane tanks.
Mm-hmm. So it'd be gas stations in space.
Gas stations in space, the team kept working on this and realized that we could use gas inside these enclosures, and they're kind of like balloons. Mm-hmm. Balloons around an asteroid, mm-hmm. where you don't have to touch the asteroid. You can use gas just to manipulate and de-spin and then move asteroids just with waves of gas. And we realized that if we put carbon monoxide gas in and you had a nickel iron asteroid, it would pull the nickel out and electroform, kind of like electroplating, but with gas, and we could build big parts to build space colonies or trusses or cylinders or whatever, like a 3D printer.
Oh, in the theater of the mind of radio, Bruce, can you describe what person would see with the Shepard design? How does it incorporate and mine an asteroid? You said a bag around it. Can you describe that in more detail?
Yeah, think of like a helium balloon with an that sort of has an open end, and it's in space. And you come up to the asteroid, you scan it, figure out what its shape is and how it's rotating, and then you extend that balloon around the asteroid using these rigid air beam struts. And then you use literally a winding system to rope in the end, kind of like when you use a rubber band on the end of a balloon, a party balloon, and then you've blown up with helium, for example. But we would do that, and the asteroid's floating inside, and you're being very careful not to touch it.
So it's rotating and floating inside your balloon.
Inside your space balloon, and then you introduce the right sort of gas, and then suddenly the space potato that is the asteroid gets caught up in the friction of the gas, and it turns out that in only a matter of hours or days, you can stop the rotation of these things so that you can deal with them.
And once it stopped, you could see what materials are in that asteroid.
Yeah, and then you can actually then push the asteroid with the same waves of gas just through vents, and kind of like, you know, when you have a ceiling fan on or a room fan, it gives you a slight pressure. Well, this would just give a very slight pressure on the asteroid, and not enough to break it up or take big pieces of it off, because these things weigh up to 1,000 tons, and any piece of it is going to destroy your whole spacecraft.
So you have to be very careful about handling these things, because they can damage the equipment really easily.
Yeah,
very interesting. Listen, Bruce, can we continue after we get to go to a break?
Yeah.
And we'll take this to the next step. You're listening to Dr. Bruce Damer on the Dr. Future Show. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer, currently about Project Shepard, which involves the capture and movement of asteroids. We do have a text from the audience saying, I thought space exploration is about going to other planets like Mars. Why would we deal with the asteroid belt first? Any response to
that,
Bruce?
That's an excellent question. It's the question of the day. Well, you know, Elon Musk, our favorite local car manufacturer of Tesla, has a rocket company called SpaceX, and he wants to go to Mars.
I mean, right. Makes
sense.
Do it
privately. And I was talking to a colleague of his about 2 months ago who said, oh, I just came from a meeting where Elon's Mars people were listing the 19 heavy launches they would need just to lift fuel and water to get one crew to Mars. And so this kind of innovation replaces all those launches. For instance, you would not even think of driving. If you were driving from New York to San Francisco without stopping at a gas station, you'd have to, you know, have a pretty big gas tank or even drive a tanker truck to do that. So you've got to set up fuel along the way.
It sort of reminds me of the electric car issues, right? That you want to be able to go as fast as you currently go, like filling up your tank. And it seems like one of the solutions for that is to just swap out the whole battery.
Yeah. And Tesla, of course, is working on that now, too. And you guys being off the grid, you're much more aware than the rest of us about being able to produce your own energy where you are.
Oh, yeah. And how reliant we are on the sun and how things radically shift when you're in the shadow and all that.
The cool thing about Shepard is it literally takes solar energy with collectors, with solar blankets on the outside of the balloon, and turns that into heat and motion to extract the resources. So it's kind of doing an off-the-grid thing, just like you guys do up there on Future Peak.
Now, I'm wondering, how do you prevent the balloon from picking up the momentum of the asteroid? I mean, maybe it'll spin with the asteroid. Right.
Now, that's tech chick talking. The true nerd amongst the couple, of course, is always Sun. In fact, that's a question asked by true nerds, and you're absolutely right. As the asteroid spins down, it spins up through turbulent dissipation, the gas in the enclosure, which then couples into the whole spacecraft. So you have to actually fire and use a bunch of xenon to fire and stop the spinning of the spacecraft. Or you can actually leave the spacecraft rotating if it provides a little bit of gyro stability.
And we have another question asking if this technique would be useful for stopping the Earth being struck by an asteroid.
That's another very excellent question. And the answer is that if we actually build a space architecture around Shepard, say, for instance, by the end of the century, if there is, say, a half a kilometer wide impactor that's threatening the Earth, say one that's coming in from far out, because we can track most of them now, but the ones that come from far out, we can't. If that's happening, we just scale up Shepard. So we may have hundreds of them in the solar system. We just build a really big one that's got a mile-wide diameter fabric enclosure, and we go and we do the same thing, this gentle redirection of this huge object, because it's just scale-independent. And, of course, you have to have the time to do it, but we have the technology already.
Someone else is asking if you are associated with Planetary Resources, the asteroid mining company.
Which is Peter Diamante's mining company.
Haven't yet had a meeting with them. I'm expecting any day now, because the interesting thing about the approaches that both Planetary Resources and another company called Deep Space Industries are taking is they don't really understand the properties of these asteroids. So when you see their websites, you see equipment bolted onto the asteroids or things attaching to and grinding in and doing extraction that way.
What are they missing?
What they're missing is they need to talk to asteroid astronomers like Peter Janiskens at the SETI Institute, who is one of our colleagues on this project. And he's done some recent talks about Shepard. He shows these concepts of, you know, literally buildings bolted onto asteroids. And his answer is, one, there's virtually no gravity. Two, if you drive a bolt or a screw or try to use a cable around an asteroid, your chances are you're going to break it up. And then it turns into a multi-ton hazard that destroys your entire mission. So
you're saying a lot of them are very brittle and they wouldn't hold together very well as
most of them are what are called consolidated rubble piles, where these rocks that could go back to the formation of the solar system just come together and they kind of attach each other by very light forces. So these are really, they're delicate, they're called friable objects. One of the other problems is that hard rock mining on the Earth, you know, I come from a mining family. My brother works in a mine. And you need so much equipment to do that, to process ores. And every time we see one of these proposals where they're processing ores or they're grinding things up and they're processing them that way, it means you have to move a good chunk of human civilization to space before you can do that. You need to have repair mechanisms and shops and robotics and processing facilities and people. You need to have Pizza Hut to feed the workers.
Yeah. You know, I'm imagining the scenarios from like last year's Philae comet probe where they were trying to land on a comet and it bounced off. Right? It's pretty hard to even just catch up with a comet, much less surround it, right?
Yeah, and the technique that came to our group was so simple because we realized you can't touch the thing so physically, but what can you do? Well, you can use gases, and gases can be used to control things. And Peter, who's the co-author of this idea, he's from Holland. And he said to me one day as we were developing this, he said, I'm Dutch, and we Dutch are sailors. And what this is, it's a type of sailing ship in space.
So you have to figure out a new docking mechanism, huh?
Yeah. You know, the age of sail, it was interesting, a very gentle force moving these multi-ton barks and schooners and things like that around the planet kind of built civilization as we know it.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, Planetary Resources has often spoken of tremendous valuable metals in the asteroids. Is that true? Is it as rich as they say it is?
Definitely. The challenge they've got, of course, is bringing all those metals to Earth. So the cost of doing it the way they're proposing it and going out and doing hard rock mining and processing, and how can they relocate that stuff to Earth safely and then landing it on the Earth? You know, it might be thousands of tons of titanium, but the cost and the problems of going and doing that are so large. And in fact, the only way you can do anything like that is to lower the cost of space flight in the first place, which is what Shepard could potentially do.
How about the surface of planets? Does that become less interesting then in terms of space exploration if we have colonies that are in zero gravity environments like the asteroid belt?
We know back in the 70s, Gerard O'Neill was a very famous physicist and designer of this idea of space colonies, pointed out in a talk that planetaries and lunar surfaces may not be the best place for people because you have all these problems. So on the moon, you've got dust and massive temperature fluctuations and radiation. And then on Mars, you've got dust, you've got windstorms that take up the whole planet for certain seasons, hundreds of miles an hour. Dryness, equipment problems will occur. You know, I think the movie The Martian will point out the real challenges of being long-term on Mars. Whereas what we found for, say, the space station, and we'll find for other trips, is that in space, you can build all these big habitats. You can keep things clean. You can keep them powered. You can manage your whole environment. You can even grow food and stuff. And then you could take sortie missions down to, say, Mars. But you don't really want to initially have any kind of a base there. It's just too risky.
Now, with the breakthroughs that are going on in biotech these days, doesn't it make sense to redesign the human body to work better in zero-gravity environments?
Well, you know, that's a bigger project. But well, it turns out that human bodies actually are pretty good in space. And you lose muscle mass, you lose some things, but they have treadmills where people are strapped down on the space station to keep their muscle mass going. But people have been up for a year or a year plus. Now, what you really want to do in a large Mars-bound craft is to have a section that's rotating.
So you have gravity. You have artificial gravity, as they say.
Artificial gravity, like in the movie Interstellar and certainly in 2001.
2001, yeah, the classic, that round space station.
That'll keep you healthy then.
And the only way to build a structure like that, you can't lift those parts from Earth. The only way to build spacecraft like that is to basically 3D print the parts in space, and that's where the Shepard Miner comes in.
We gotta go to a break. Bruce, you want to stay on? We'll bring you on after the news.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks. Let's talk to Dr. Bruce Damer, Dr. Future Show.
Yeah, stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer about asteroid explorations, not just mining, but asteroid explorations. Bruce, I wanted to link this to another one of your favorite topics here. I've heard that asteroids and comets might actually have led to Earth's life, a biological life, that life may have come from comets and such. Is there any evidence for that, as far as you know?
Yeah, in fact, I was just out in Western Australia for a wonderful 3,000-kilometer trek, you know, not on foot, to ancient landscapes in an area called the Pilbara, which has some of the oldest rocks on the planet, 3.5 billion years old. And these rocks have signs of life in them called stromatolites. They're literally layer upon layer of fossil microbial communities, and we were able to touch them and hear from the geologists what they think the climate was like back then and the conditions at the time of life's beginning.
Now, this would have been several mass planetary extinctions ago, wouldn't it?
Yeah, in fact, if you went back to the Earth in those days, you're talking temperatures of 120 degrees, median temperatures, and you know, an atmosphere that is full of all kinds of things, an orange sky with acid in the atmosphere and methanes and carbon dioxide and an ocean that's rusty red full of iron and just rocky volcanic islands. Really, you'd have to wear a spacesuit pretty much. I mean, you wouldn't survive very long there.
And there are microbes that actually thrive in such environments?
Yeah, even today there are microbes that can basically survive off of only chemical energy and not needing the sun, and can survive in very hot temperatures, close to boiling point. Certainly when you pasteurize your milk, you're heating it to the point where you kill all the microbes. So pretty much that's the upper limit.
So is it possible that stromatolites would have an extraterrestrial origin?
Well, I think in a sense they do, in that we know that asteroids, from picking up many, many samples of asteroids around the world, they contain amino acids, they contain nucleic acids, and they contain fatty acids, which are the building blocks that you need for a living system. So back 4 billion years ago, maybe when life started, this stuff was raining in. It was called infall, and it was coming in a lot more often than today. And so it was landing on these rocky landscapes and being washed into little pools. So there would have been concentration of that stuff, not life itself in those asteroids, but the building blocks for life.
Mm-hmm. So you still think the evidence suggests that life originated here?
I think so. I think if you add what's called panspermia or an extraterrestrial origin, you're just adding complexity to a theory. And, you know, nature likes simplicity. And I think that if you study the life on Earth, you realize how closely coupled it is to the Earth. So it seems to me we don't need to add an extraterrestrial origin.
Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, then does that suggest to you that such processes could go on throughout the universe that way?
Yeah, I think when you look up in the night sky and you see the Milky Way galaxy, and we now know that there's billions of exoplanets or planets around other stars, and a big chunk of those are rocky planets that possibly have liquid water on their surfaces, kind of like Earth's, you know, they call them...
The Goldilocks zone.
In the Goldilocks zone, where it's not too hot and not too cold. And so there's probably a lot of them, and based upon our model for an Earth proposed hypothesis for how life started, I would expect that life can get started on a lot of those planets. The real question, I think, is going to come that complex life takes a lot more chance episodes and just dumb luck to emerge, complex life like us or plants.
So there could have been many false starts throughout the universe in creating life, and it wouldn't get very far before something extincted it.
Well, for instance, here's the perfect example for you. The Earth, 7/8 of the time that there was life on the Earth, it was all just microbial communities, you know, single-celled communities. That's most of the time. And it took all that time for those communities to clean out the oceans of iron and then to put oxygen into the oceans and then into the atmosphere, which then that oxygen could be harnessed for energy to allow larger life. So if it took almost 3 billion years for life, microbial life, to do that job, you can imagine other planets going all the way to their ends, or to some big event like a big asteroid impact, and never being able to transition to complex life.
I have a question for you, Bruce. If this evolution of life on Earth, which we will consider being successful since we're here today thinking about it, talking about it, if we're going to take these walking bags of water that have been so successful here off the planet, what is that going to do for us, and how... what is life going to achieve if we get off the planet?
Well, in the very long perspective, the Earth is going to carry on rotating around the sun and orbiting and being relatively stable for the next 4 to 5 billion years without some kind of big impact. But then the sun's going to run out of hydrogen and it's going to start burning other fuels, and then it grows large. It turns into a red giant. And it will basically consume the Earth. So the Earth is gone. So all the life that is stuck down at the bottom of the gravity well, which includes us, is gone in the longer picture, a very long picture. So my feeling about this is that if life gets to be complex, life's whole prerogative is to go on, is to make a copy. So if life gets complex, there's some kind of underwriting force driving it to make a copy. And then in the case of us, that's making a copy of the Earth. So one of the things we came up with Shepard was you could encapsulate an icy planetesimal, which we love that term, an asteroid with a bunch of ice in it, melt it down not to a gas but to a liquid globule of water, and introduce biology. So you end up with an aquarium or terrarium in space. And
I like that. So we're kind of like goldfish looking for a new ocean to inhabit, huh?
Exactly. And
or we could, so it would be possible to maybe to imbue all kinds of asteroids out there with biological life so we can ensure that biological life continues?
Yeah, and not only that, it's fairly low tech to do that. And the second thing is that we can live off of that. So if we're in space, we need hamburgers or tofu burgers or whatever it is, you just go to one of these biospheres and harvest. And we can design the biosphere like people design those glass globes you can buy that have a few shrimp in them and a plant and some algae and whatnot, and they're sealed. They can go on for decades.
Yeah, you know? I'm kind of thinking about how when freeways were first being built so that cars could go everywhere, the big opportunity for entrepreneurs was to get your own little roadside stand and get a gas station, and then, you know, little towns grew up for the tourists. So it's almost like we're imagining taking that model and mapping it out to the solar system. So we'll have all these little asteroid gas stations for tourists that are on their way out to the rings of Saturn.
Yeah, my grandparents had a little food stand at a railroad stop.
Wow.
I mentioned, so yeah, kind of makes sense. So there would be an opportunity to get resources throughout the galaxy, actually throughout the solar system initially. This way
yeah,
we could actually seed the solar
millions,
system.
Millions and millions of these objects, and we're built out of them. So our iron and our nickel and all those sorts of things that you have in your cell phone come from mostly mines around, some of it around mines around asteroid strikes, like up in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
And then the water that you drink and the air you breathe, pretty much most of it comes from those objects out in the solar system. So it's, I think any intelligent space-faring civilization that you would be able to see through a telescope would have a ring of these objects, kind of like Saturn's rings, but it would have a ring of millions of these objects around their home planet that
so
they were using.
It's almost like our home planet is a catcher's mitt for precious resources that are in the atmosphere, or I guess in the space around our star, and we're just collecting it as we go.
Yeah.
Hoping not to destroy the planet with the impact as we get close to them.
Very good point. And most of these objects are pretty small. So, I mean, if you brought them close to in low Earth orbit, you know, they're small enough. They create a nice light show coming in, but they're not a threat to anyone. They're pretty small objects.
Sure. And if we can catch them really in a predictable way, then we get rid of that fear that some random danger is going to extinct the planet as it did several times in the past.
Yeah, the dinosaurs didn't have space programs and or budgets, or they didn't have Tesla and things like that.
So they
right. Just, one day it came in, you know.
And we're going to go for a break right now. Hang tight. We'll be back with more Dr. Future Show and Dr. Bruce Damer.
Got another question from the audience here. Is it ethically correct to infect the solar system with our form of life? What do you say to that, Bruce?
Well, you know, ethics requires two sides to the thing, and the solar system, as far as we know, has no life in it at all.
So it's ours to take.
Well, hold on. I disagree with that remark. We are in the solar system.
Yeah. Well, we're it, right?
Yeah, I mean,
our planet, you mean?
To complain about it. If we don't take life off the planet, chances are it's not going to come from any other source.
Yeah, if we want immortality as a planetary intelligence, then we need to, like you say, copy ourselves, get off the planet, and be sustainable wherever we are.
And here's another great point here. Just as people who traveled on early sailing ships and tried to create colonies, or people who live in Antarctica, for example, in those bases.
Yes.
If you're living off planet and you have just a few hundred members of your group, we're going to learn a lot about ourselves, managing our civilization much more sanely also managing biospheres for sustenance and survival. And we're going to learn a ton about those processes and how to be better human beings that we can apply to those that are on a Earth that may be under stress by end of century.
Mm-hmm. So it would buy us more time as a highly evolved species to think of ourselves as a solar system inhabitants as opposed to a planetarian.
In fact, Stephen Hawking said recently that if we don't establish our presence in the solar system in space in the next 100 years, we're going to simply just turn inward and kind of consume ourselves because we're going to be hitting all these problems. If we don't have a space to expand, we're not going to do too well.
Yeah.
Because we just keep growing. We just keep wanting more stuff and more phones. And
well, you know, again, one person is expressing their singular point of view, and I actually have a very different belief about what human potential is, and I think we actually haven't explored the inner spaces enough, and that's why we are creating so much stress and turbulence, because we've kind of forgotten how to look inside for peace, calm, wisdom, self-confidence, self-esteem, self-knowing. And the world that we've created is coming from that inability to be at peace with our center. So, you know, let's not just throw the baby out with the bathwater and assume that just because Stephen Hawking is really smart that he's the only one who knows what's possible in the future.
Good point. And just reminds me, we had a wonderful friend over this morning who's a great yoga instructor. And it just reminded me that as yoga comes to the West, in Europe, places like that, and people are learning these practices. My other friend who's from India tells me that India has gone so commercial and so ostentatious that pretty much a lot of that tradition where yoga came from is disappearing in daily life in middle-class India as they go, you know, full throttle to get their Mercedes and their big screen TV and everything. And that's so things move around.
Poetic justice, they call it.
Now it's up to us to develop the emotional literacy, the spiritual awareness.
That's right.
And there's something to be said about both internal and external frontiers, though. And I do think that this is really a time in history where we haven't had a lot of new space to go to, where pioneers can expand into physically. So it kind of makes sense that space would be the next frontier as well as inner space. You know, it's not an either or thing.
And yet to get to space, we need to study the sea. And the sea is still a place of huge mystery on the planet. And really, we need to discover sustainability wherever we are, on the land, on the sea, in space, in little capsules of space colonies.
I'm an optimist. I think that we're doing all these things at once. We're discovering ways to be more sustainable, and we're expanding, and we're learning, and we're, as Steven Pinker wrote in his recent book, we're a much less violent civilization than we were 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago. And we're getting there. We're on the track.
Yeah, it's an interesting question coming in. Someone wants to know if you're an advocate of some kind of modern version of Noah's Ark. And should we take more than just our species and support system into the solar system?
Well, you know, we don't have a choice. There was a movie back in 1972 with Bruce Dern called Silent Running. I don't know if any of your listeners...
You and I both, we share a love for that movie. That movie just melts you to tears.
Yeah, and it's absolutely stunning. It's basically these ships, which Bruce Dern is one of the pilots of, and they have these domes with these biospheres in them, and they're carrying the life of the Earth. And then they get the order from corporate headquarters to blow up the domes and return home. Like, there's been some boardroom decision. I guess there's no forests left on the Earth or something. And, oh, we can just dump these. We don't even know what they are. And Bruce Dern denies the order and takes his ship through the rings of Saturn and survives. And he's got the only dome left, and it's the final song is by Joan Baez. And it's just, as you say, son, it's a heartstring puller.
Yeah, the first ecology movie.
It was. It really was.
Yeah.
So will we have any of this in our lifetime, Bruce? We go to space?
I think that it's happening, but the investment, our proposal, our team's proposal to anyone who will listen is that they invest and it could be a private new space, invest a few million a year. We'll start running demonstrator flights in low Earth orbit with scale prototypes, and then off the space station, and then out to collect a dead satellite, collect rocks, stuff like that. And we need 10 to 20 years of doing that just to master the techniques. So very low investment costs, like the solar sail programs that are going on, and just to prove it up. And then later on, somebody gets a bee in their bonnet, or maybe we get a comet captured in the Earth-Moon system by accident, and then everybody will be after it for its resources, and then Shepard will be ready to fly.
Yeah, it's like, get ready now and avoid the rush, huh?
Yeah.
Now, you had, as we know, tremendous interest in the first generation of virtual worlds when they came out back in the mid-90s. Do you see any connection with this new revolution in virtual worlds today and space? Maybe there might be some kind of space virtual world that could be compelling?
Yeah, I think it's all connected. So the reason I did virtual worlds was because I thought it would be a new medium for human interaction, mm-hmm. but it would be a new medium for science and for engineering. So you could actually go into a virtual, you know, biosphere or a virtual spaceship. And for 12, 15 years, our team built virtual spaceship models for NASA to allow them to test out new ideas. And then that led to all this work on Shepard. So it was really a complete connection. And since a spacecraft like Shepard is run remotely, mm-hmm. you know, from Earth, so you have to do 3D modeling of everything, and you have to do it very, very slowly and carefully. So it's all about telepresence. That's putting the human, the power of the human mind into robots and other things and extending us that way. So that's all virtual worlds, really.
So in a sense, we'd be able to explore much of the solar system and feel like we were there simply by having the right gear for doing that. Huh?
Well, the Curiosity rover on Mars has a mast with a camera on it at the height of an ordinary walking human. Hmm. So that when the drivers are looking out, they relate that to walking on Mars. And the rover drivers the last 10 years have talked about being on Mars, feeling like they're there.
Sure, because you can see it, you can hear it, you can't smell it, obviously, but I guess just rolling around makes you feel like you're moving. That's what virtual worlds do. They give you that sensory experience of being somewhere.
Yeah, and the Mars rover is an avatar for a person, really, on Mars.
Hmm. So maybe we can have more such rides for the populace, not just for a scientific exploration.
Well, yeah, in 1 minute here, maybe can you talk about whether it's better to just send robots out there with these sensory apparatus?
Or not humans? Or,
what's the waste case? Waste the resources on humans.
Yeah, where do you stand on this human versus robot debate about exploration?
I think you need both, and you need to precede the humans with robots to really prove it up and do a whole lot of work. And then when someone has a vision like Elon Musk saying, before I die, I want to stand and see a sunset on Mars, and he has the resources to do it, then you've done a lot of good work. And by the time they're ready to do it, you've proved up how to do it with the robots, and those guys decide we're going.
Yeah. Final couple minutes here, Bruce. First, what are you doing next? What's on your plate these days?
Well, I'm going to write a new book about what I call the combinatorial universe. And of course, we're debating whether that's a catchy title or not, but it's about how the universe unwinds into complexity using all these combinations of things. And it's a new way of thinking about how the universe unfolds.
Hmm. Is there a place where people interested can track what you're doing?
Yep, damer.com, just my last name, damer.com, and it has links to all these projects. And you can find me on Facebook and Bruce Damer and YouTube channels, and it's just all out there.
Great, great, good. And you're working with Dr. Damer, David Damer, at the university here, right?
Yep, at UCSC. He's my collaborator on this model for the origin of life, which I'm also writing up, and I'll present him the latest version of the essay tomorrow that will be published next year. It's on a whole new aspect of how life may have started.
Huh. Do you think we'll be able to create life from scratch?
I think we're going to be able to do in the lab to get the first few steps going and watch it. Whether we can get a full living system, I think, is a big question.
Yeah.
But if we can watch those first steps work.
Okay. Well, listen, we got to go. So thanks, Bruce, for being on the show. Look forward to having you on again really soon.
Thank you. you guys.
All right. Have a good day.
Good day.
Yeah. I'm talking to Dr. Bruce Damer, and this is the Dr. Future Show. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll talk to you next week.
This is KSCO Santa Cruz. Bye-bye, my dog.